Accession number 28354, Reel 19.
Now, you were saying that Frank Chris's wife was in charge of everything.
Yeah, and left behind all these files, which are called, well, I could finish it off. There was a great filing cabinet with all these things in it. My wife used to pull this metal filing cabinet open, and then I hear a slam as she shut it again, horrified with what she saw. And, in fact, my wife had no experience of being a senior officer's wife anywhere. I'd always been at sea in ships, and she felt this all responsibilities heavily, and in fact got really rather run down worrying about all this and not sleeping and taking sleeping pills and until my PA, a Wren officer, came up and went through these files, threw the whole lot away, threw the filing cabinet out of Amberley House, and gave my wife a lovely empty desk and told her not to worry. But actually, the final event which took my wife out of this worrying situation about what she should be doing was in November of that year, when she got a letter from Prue Twist in England saying, "I've been thinking of you. It's how tremendously busy you must be with the British Legion Poppy Day." And my wife had not done a damn thing. And so, in an absolute panic, because crikey, what ought she to be doing? She rang up the captain's wife of the naval base, Anne Pluggy, and said to Anne, "Look, I've got this letter. What should I be doing?" And Anne said, "Don't worry, Lady O'Brien." No, sorry, Mrs. O'Brien it was then. "Don't worry. It's all in hand. We've done it all, and it's been absolutely lovely not having the fleet commander's wife ringing up on the telephone all the time giving us advice." So my wife then knew where her duty lay and proceeded to follow it. But I took over command of the Far East Fleet and the headquarters, which was known colloquially as Sleepy Hollow. Now, the Far East Fleet was big in those days. I mean, there were two carriers still east of Suez. There was at least one helicopter carrier. There was the amphibious force. It wasn't very big, but it was there, and I had a Commodore amphibious forces under me. There were quite a number of frigates. There was the 7th Submarine Squadron, or was it the 1st? Doesn't matter. 7th Submarine Squadron, I think it was, plus HMS 4th. The depot ship, the submarine depot ship. There was a repair ship, it was Triumph then, a converted aircraft carrier. And there was the dockyard, a considerable dockyard. And there was a station that stretched from Japan to the north, to New Zealand to the south, to Mombasa to the west. It's actually Mombasa came in later when Aden went, but never mind. It was the most colossal station. India, Burma, Malaysia, Philippines, etc. And there was a huge staff. My chief of staff was a rear admiral. The first one was Dennis Mason. And it was very nice to see him there because, in fact, as Naval Secretary, I had made sure he got promoted, because Dennis Mason was the captain in the anti-submarine warfare squadron at Londonderry, and did it so well that he was asked to stay on and not have a second sea command, and told that this wouldn't affect his promotion to Rear Admiral. But when the time came, and his papers were in front of the board, it became perfectly clear to me that they were all thinking, here's this chap who hasn't been to sea a second time, what about this other bloke alongside him who has? And the other bloke was going to get the advantage. And I arranged for a further report on him to be written by another officer and put before the board, which presented this argument to them. And in fact, Dennis Mason was promoted to Rear Admiral. I knew the bloke that wasn't actually in his stead, but I'm sorry for him, but I think it was still right. And so there was Dennis as my chief of staff. He's actually older than me, two terms above me at Dartmouth. He served me marvellously and enjoyed him. But of course, having a good chief of staff like that, and having you had chaps of captain's rank as chief staff officer intelligence, chief staff officer technical, chief staff officer operations, etc., chief staff officer administration, all these captains, all superior officers, and they were selected intelligently and well. Why spend any time in Singapore as the admiral when you've got that enormous station around you? So I did spend a very great deal of time going around my station in proportion to the time I spent in Singapore. I spent quite a lot of time there, obviously, but I took every opportunity to go in other places while the fleet was being perfectly well run by all these able officers below me. And this was underlined, so to speak, when my daughter went to a dance, a ball at HMS Terror, the shore base, one night. And as she entered the entrance, somebody took a photograph of her in her pretty evening dress going in. Behind it was a poster, like the poster that news vendors had with Stop Press on it. And it said, Stop Press, Fleet Commander Visits Singapore. So somebody else noticed that I liked going to other places. This also, of course, well, now I'll go on a bit. Almost at once after I'd taken over the fleet in Singapore, came Mr. Callaghan's, or Mr. Wilson's, whichever you like it, devaluation, 1967, wasn't it? Devaluation of the pound. And with the devaluation of the pound, the decision to withdraw from the Far East. At that time, an unspecified date, but I think it was thought to be the mid-1970s. And this caused a lot of upset in the Far East. In particular, Mr. Lee Kuan Yew, the Prime Minister, and this pushed me and many others of us closer to Lee Kuan Yew than we might otherwise have been, and seeing more of him, because he was very angry at the devaluation, Lee Kuan Yew, and with it went the decision to leave the Far East. He didn't think we ought to go, and it's interesting that all politicians in England thought we ought to get out of the Far East, and they argued it, and this is Labour, of course, arguing it, on economic grounds, of course, that we simply couldn't afford to run a big fleet and a big army and air force out there. But they also argued it because we weren't wanted, that a post-colonial argument, we ought to stop being out there and stop being colonial. And my experience in going around the Far East was that whatever they might say in public, the politicians did not think that at all. The Thais, I'm absolutely certain, wanted us to stay. The Filipinos, I'm sure, wanted us to stay. Lee Kuan Yew seemed to want us to stay. And at that time, Tunku Abdul Rahman, who was the president of Malaysia and who was very much an Anglophile, I'm also sure wanted us to stay. And I don't believe that actually it was a correct political argument to say that we should get out of Singapore and out of the Far East because we weren't wanted. At that time, I think, although the politician perhaps couldn't say it too loudly, they'd liked us to have stayed. And certainly Lee Kuan Yew's reaction was to that effect. And so I remember asking Lee Kuan Yew what he would say to, I can't remember who the Labour Mr. Thomas was, I don't remember who the Labour minister was who Wilson sent out to discuss the leaving of the Far East with these overseas prime ministers. What would you say to him? And he said, oh, Lee Kuan Yew said to me, I'll be nice to him because he's a very old friend. But I don't agree, he said, with what you're doing in Great Britain now. And one of these, he said, in Great Britain now, when somebody holds his hands out and says, give, you give. Here in Singapore, when somebody holds his hands out and says, give, I slap it and tell him, but if he's done his best to better himself, then I will give. But when he's just begging, and your people are begging at the moment, I don't give. He was arguing rather against our welfare state, I remember. He was cross with us. I have a letter Lee Kuan Yew wrote me when I wrote to him about... the first thing I had to do in the rundown was give up the naval base, because that was the first thing to go. And at the early discussions on this, I obviously was corresponding with the Prime Minister. And I have a letter in my study next door from him, which is quite an interesting one, saying that when he became Prime Minister, he had not thought of... That he'd have this was going to happen, but unlike Malta, which seemed to be belly aching rather the British leaving, he wasn't one to belly ache. The Chinese were pretty stoical people, and they were going to make a good job of this. This is roughly the sense of the letter. He thanked me by letter, and we were going to get on well together, and we were together going to make a very good job of this. And in fact, I found the rundown of the dockyard was as smooth as could be. There was nothing got in the way, and Lee Kuan Yew was a great facilitator of it.
Can I ask you a question? We're now in 67, late 67, devaluation was then. The Vietnam War, which is just around the corner, was almost at its... in the middle almost of its worst period.
It was, yes, yeah.
What impact did that have at all on what you had to do in every sense, on your command of the Far East Station?
We weren't in the Vietnam War. One of the wise decisions of Mr. Wilson, actually... it's hard to say how much did it affect us. The Vietnam was more a political effect around the Far East than it was to us. I don't think it made much difference to my running the Far East fleet or the.
It didn't affect then the availability or otherwise of U.S. naval ships for exercise purposes.
No, we still exercise with the U.S. Navy. We're still in CETO, the Southeast Asia Treaty Organization, and the Americans still took part in those exercises. So did we. I went to Vietnam.
You went to Vietnam.
Yes, I could talk about that since you've asked about it. Yes. Vietnam was obviously current all the time. I went for a week to Vietnam.
To the south, obviously.
And flew to Saigon, where I stayed with Murray McElhose, the ambassador who was subsequently governor of Hong Kong, you remember. I like Murray and Peep, his wife, very much, and they were very kind to us. I stayed with Murray McElhose, and then... I went down in the Delta and saw the Admiral there, and then I flew up to... So I was briefed in Saigon, went down to the Delta, then went up to Da Nang, and then flew back to Saigon. This was a terribly interesting week. The Americans were the innovators, the introducers... of the slide briefing. The briefing when you have slides to show what you're doing. It starts off with a whole lot of US flags and then it has the command emblems and all the rest of it, and then it goes into the briefing. It's very stilted, it's very stage managed, and it tells you very little, and it's extraordinarily boring. And I was briefed first of all in Saigon by a rear admiral who subsequently became chief of naval staff. He was picked out by his name's gone, that's terrible name. But anyway, I got a nationwide briefing from him, so to speak. There's a good story about him, in fact. While I was staying with Murray McElhose, I asked him about a lady called Madame Anne, A-N, who had been the wife of a minister when I had previously visited Saigon in 1958, and who had taken me shopping in an enormous limousine. And I wondered what had happened to her. And I saw Murray McElhose's face sort of drop, and he told me where she was. He didn't tell me what had happened to her. When I'd met her in 1958, she'd been the wife of a minister in President Zeme's government. In previous incarnation, she'd been the wife of a Frenchman. That's before the war. Now, when I came back, she was the mistress of the American admiral, and I actually saw her, and I always wonder what she subsequently became under communism. I think I've told you this story before, actually. Never mind. So, as I say, I went down to the Delta and was shown all of what they were doing down there by the admiral there. These were the patrol boats. This is where President Kerry, he wasn't president, where Mr. Kerry, no doubt, was operating. It was in those boats that we heard a great deal about. And then I flew up to Da Nang, and that was the most interesting. Da Nang was the most enormous base, huge, huge base. And it was there that I first saw that the Americans, in fact, with their tremendous logistic requirements, were having to have more of their frontline troops defending their bases than actually were in the front line fighting the Viet Cong. And Da Nang was a typical example. It was enormous. And the rear admiral there, he was a submariner who was in charge of the base, showed me a graph. One of the interesting bits of the graph was the increase in the use of electricity, and it went up exponentially. It was, and this was, of course, it went up all the time, because every time an American went on a rest and recreation leave to Hong Kong, he bought himself a hi-fi, and he bought himself an air conditioning unit, and he installed these things in his little residence in Da Nang, in his tent or in his basher hut or whatever it was, and up went the electricity demand. And equally up went every other demand. And as we were crossing the water in this admiral's barge to go to look at something or other, we were passed by a very large landing craft with cases and cases of stuff piled on it in a sort of pinnacle mountain on the fore end of this landing craft. And I said, "What's all that lot?" And the admiral said to me, "Mineral water, admiral. Mineral water. We've got enough to piss the bastards out of Vietnam." And that really epitomized the base mentality, as I saw it, of the Americans in their operations. It was huge. And here was the PX was colossal. You could buy anything there. And here was all this mineral water that could piss the bastards out. I liked that American admiral, actually. But he spoke the truth and saw through all that was being done. Flying down to Saigon from Da Nang, this huge base they had there, we flew over in the middle of the jungle where the the 5th Cavalry Wild, which I believe is a very famous American regiment. And again, the base was simply huge. And I just made some inquiries there, and I discovered that for every division they had there, or the equivalent of 3 battalions, 2 battalions were defending the base while 1 was fighting the Viet Cong. Then from Saigon, when I got down there, I went out to Station 77, wasn't it? Or I don't know, anyway. It was there the carriers were in the Gulf of Tonkin. 2 carriers and flying all the support operations ashore. And you'll have to stop because I must get this admiral's name. The admiral was Rear Admiral Cousins. One American admiral who really, really impressed me. His briefing, he gave himself without slides. And he obviously was absolutely on top of what he was doing, was supposed to do, and was going on. And it was as interesting and as informative a briefing as I've ever heard. What was so interesting about him was that there was he had none of the informality of the American admiral, the normal American admiral. When he came into a room, every single officer jumped to attention and stayed there until the admiral said, "Sit down." It was almost royal. Nobody spoke until the admiral spoke first. But he was perfectly pleasant with them. This wasn't a fearful discipline. It was a respectful discipline. It was the sort of discipline which we'd like to think we're used to. And I'd not seen it in the American Navy in this way. No doubt it's there, and I hadn't observed it. But he was in charge. He subsequently became SAC Land. Yes, he did. He became SAC Land commanding in Norfolk, Virginia, in that big NATO job there. But at this time, he was merely a rear admiral. They were flying tremendous number of missions from those 2 ships, no doubt defoliating the whole of Vietnam. But I found no disbelief in their mission. They were in it wholeheartedly. They didn't have second thoughts, I don't think, about what they were doing. They were. And I was looking at it from, looking at all this stuff in Vietnam from outside, I was really horrified. I was really, with the scale of their sophisticated operation against what was really high class insurgency, and obviously their inability to deal with it with their sophisticated equipment, and it ended in the denouement we all know. But somehow it was sad, and I didn't like what I saw at all, or what they were doing. That was Vietnam, but at least I was so pleased to meet Cousins.
When you make a visit like that, do you subsequently have to make a report which wends its way back to the first?
Yes, I will have written a report, yes. I can't remember what I said, but I will have written a report, yes. Let's go on visiting places. The sequence of visits doesn't really matter, does it? I don't think so. Except that prior to this, of course, this is not a visit, we'd had the evacuation of Aden, which took the whole of my fleet. Nobody quite knew. The evacuation of Aden took place fairly early on in my time there. Yes. Must have been early 38, I think. And
early 68.
Sorry.
Yes.
Early 68.
This is when Mad Mitch was driving around the crater.
Yes, this is 68, yes. Practically the whole of my fleet was there for that. Because it wasn't known exactly what would happen. So we had Ocean and Bulwark, So the two commandos embarked in those ships. Eagle, with the flag officer second in command, who was Edward Ashmore, who had been my director of plans once upon a time, now my second in command. Many of the amphibious warfare units there, of course, the two helicopter carriers were amphibious warfare units, and those sat off Aden over the horizon. They were not sort of visible. We weren't actually using our ships to evacuate troops. That was done separately. There's nothing really more said about it. In the event, this thing went totally peacefully, as we know, and everybody got out, and nobody was slaughtered, assassinated, or murdered in the process, not too many were. And the fleet then started to run down from its Aden presence, but I was obliged to keep the carrier within striking distance, and to keep one commando in the commando carrier within 4 days' notice. I think it was 4 days' notice of landing at Aden. That meant they couldn't go very far. And this went on it was initially, I think, at 1 day's notice, then it extended and extended. And I finally, after a month, I got it extended to whatever notice it was to get them to Gan, so that the Marines could get out of this cooped-up ship and get stretch their legs and do something. And it's here that I had a curious signal with my Air Force opposite number. Air Marshal Sir Rochford Hughes, who commanded the Far East Air Force, he was a terribly nice man, actually. He was... a jolly difficult man, and I made him a signal saying that I now had got the notice extended for 45 commando, and when the ships were going to Gan, could RAF make a charge at Gan, could the Royal Marine Commando land at Gan? And just stop it a second, will you? And I got a reply from the Commander Far East Air Force, which I'm going to quote because it's so wonderful. It's just a wonderful one. "I am sure," he said, "that you are aware that Gan is only a few feet above the sea level, and that you will take every care to ensure that your task force does not swamp it!" "As it happens, the island is under the command of a squadron leader at the present time, and I am slightly worried that in his anxiety to please, he could unwittingly impair the operational capability of his staging post. I would be grateful if you could ensure that all requests to visit RAF Gan made by ships of the task force are coordinated by the task force commander and put as a consolidated program to the commanding officer of Gan. It would be just as serious to me to learn that all my airmen are out on their knees from too much football as it would be to learn that they have run out of beer. I'm sure that you will understand my predicament." Now, this may sound as though it was a flippant signal. It wasn't. It was serious. And because it was followed by his captain administration saying, "The 500 souls at Gan have only sufficient manpower and logistic support to meet their own and RAF staging post needs. In order to help you, it will be necessary for you to provide detailed requirements so that the implications can be studied. Gan have asked that you restrict passengers to casualty evacuation only, and that calls for their overnight accommodation be kept to an absolute minimum." That's about as unfriendly to a sister service as you could be. This describes it completely. I replied as follows: "Problem well understood, and Commander Amphibious Forces instructed accordingly. I am confident that the gentle feet of 42 Commando Royal Marines will leave nothing but fairy footprints upon the sacred soil of Gan." I got no response from that, except that when they all came back from this, I was given a certificate, which I have in front of me now, signed by Di Morgan, commanding 42 Commando, and Jed Mansfield, commanding the task force, and Arthur Power, commanding HMS Bulwark, which is entitled The Sole Run Ashore, spelled S-O-L-E, 20th of March, 1968. With great respect, we offer you a gentle footprint from 4-2 to demonstrate and guarantee how light a fairy foot can be. Rest confident that not one man disturbed the sacred soil of Gan. And here is the footprint, which was made by the dentists out of dental whatnot. And in the middle of this Royal Marine footprint is a pillbox. And on the pillbox is the mixture. Do not exceed the stated dose. And inside the pillbox is some sand from Gan. I thought this was absolutely grand. I've kept it. There we are. That just about sums up my relationship with Ben Nutson, really. Not really, with the air commander. I found him a very difficult man on all subjects.
Now, you've spent some time on this, you dashed off at one point to go and get that framed